Let's get started with Genesis. So after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 sections, and you have the prologue, and then you have 5 sections that describe the origins of the nations, 5 sections that describe the origins of Israel, and the 10th and final of these 10 sections is the generations of Jacob. That's found from 37 verse 2 through the end of chapter 50. And the beginning of that, of course, there's division in the family. So in chapter 37, all the brothers are together, but they're fighting, and Joseph is sold into slavery. In chapter 38, you have Judah apart from his brothers. In chapter 39 through 41, you have Joseph apart from his brothers. And then you have in chapters 42 through 47, which is the section, the portion of the generations of Jacob that we find ourselves in now, you have 3 journeys down to Egypt. So you have the first journey in chapter 42. You have the second journey in chapter 43 through 45. And then you have the third journey, which includes the whole family in 46 and 47. And then you have the last section of this, last portion of this overall section in 48 through 50 with the passing of Jacob and Joseph. And chapter 42. So the chapter 42 and chapter 43 through 45, so the first two journeys follow a similar pattern. You begin, the first scene is a journey to Egypt. The second scene is arrival in Egypt. The third scene is a first audience with Joseph. And then you have the brothers in some form of custody or captivity. And then you have a second audience with Joseph. Then they leave Egypt and then they go home. And so last week we spent time talking about the second audience with Joseph, so that's scene 5 of journey 2, and I'm hoping tonight, I think there's at least a possibility we'll get done with the second journey, or at least get done with scene 5 of the second journey, so we'll make it as far as we can into chapter 45. So we left off last week, in scene 5, the second audience with Joseph, so that scene as a whole goes from 44:14 to 45:15, and so you have the brothers return to Joseph's house. You have Joseph accuses them of stealing the cup. You have Judah's first defense in verse 16, and Joseph's refusal in verse 17, and then you have from 18 through 34, you have this tremendously moving speech by Judah, and it's actually the longest of the speeches in the book of Genesis, which is very significant. And so Judah starts out with an introduction. He asks to speak in verse 18. And then in verses 19 through 29, there's a review of past events. And we discussed that in detail last week about how it revealed in a significant way, and in a way that we would not maybe have seen. We didn't know. It reveals to the reader that Joseph had been warned that Benjamin's coming down from Canaan to Egypt was going to put Jacob's life at risk. So Joseph knew that and yet persisted, or had at least been warned of that, had been told that, and yet persisted with his plan of forcing Benjamin to come down anyways. And so that revealed something about Joseph's character as well, even as it revealed the way in which Judah's character had been comprehensively transformed. And so we pick up our working through the text in 44 and verse 30. And in 44 verse 30 through 32, we find the consequences if Benjamin does not return. So earlier, we find that Judah said, "We already told you that this is putting our father's life at risk." And now Judah is going to very emotionally describe what's going to happen to Jacob if Judah comes back to the land of Canaan without Benjamin. "Now therefore, when I come to thy servant, my father, and the lad be not with us, seeing that his life is bound up in the lad's life, it shall come to pass when he seeth that the lad is not with us, that he will die. And thy servants shall bring down the gray hairs of thy servant, our father, with sorrow, to the grave. For thy servant became surety for the lad unto my father, saying, If I bring him not unto thee, then I shall bear the blame to my father forever. And so Judah comes to the rhetorical climax, as it were, of his arguments for why Benjamin should not be allowed to stay as a slave while the others go home. He says, if I go home without Benjamin, it's going to lead to the death of my father. And once again, we talked about this last week, we see Judah's total identification with the will of his father, the very father whose he was not the favorite of. So he knew he was not the father's favorite. His father's favorite was Benjamin. And yet, despite that, Judah so identified with his father that he valued the will and the desire of his father more than his own will, desire, and his own future. And though Jacob is a very imperfect father, and though Judah has been a very imperfect son, there is a strong hint here of what we will find in Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Luke chapter 22 and verse 41, and he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast and kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And so even though this is, and we'll talk about this in more detail, even though Judah's been very imperfect and Jacob's been very imperfect as well, you still have that not my will, but yours be done that we find in Gethsemane. We find that in a very imperfect way pointed forward to. You can see strong overtones of that in the text. And of course, that's borne out and even strengthened by what we find in the last two verses of the chapter. Verse 33, Now therefore I pray thee, let thy servant abide instead of the lad, a bondman to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brethren. For how shall I go up to my father, and the lad be not with me, lest peradventure I see the evil that shall come on my father? Judah offers himself as a substitute, just as Christ offered himself as our substitute. Of course, Judah was far from innocent, and indeed it's important to recognize that Judah is older, he's an older man, and a younger man is a more valuable slave than an older man, because they're still, so Judah is not old, he's not aged, but he's several years older than Benjamin. And so if Benjamin comes as a slave, then he's got a number of additional years in which to slave away before his death, whereas Judah has correspondingly fewer years. And so Benjamin is actually a more valuable slave than Judah is. So the trade that Judah is offering is not a one-to-one swap. Judah is worth less to Joseph. If Joseph was really the Egyptian taskmaster that he's pretending to be, then, you know, a younger slave, you're going to get more years of work out of them. Let's see, where were we? And Judah, of course, was far from innocent. He had a lot of black marks on his record. And yet, I think the overtones of substitutionary offering of one person for someone else should not be missed. And indeed, the fact that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah only underscores that. And though Judah, you know, had been very flawed in his past, in this particular scenario, he was under the impression that Benjamin was guilty. And though Judah was guilty of many things, he was innocent in regards to the cup. And so even though Judah was very flawed, you still have that the innocent being substituted for the guilty, at least from Judah's perspective. And that points forward to Christ as well. And in many ways, both Judah and Joseph are types that point forward to Christ. And one of the reasons that I've highlighted some of what seemed to be, or at least seemed to me, to be flaws in Joseph's character is not to deny that there are many ways in which Joseph points forward to Jesus, but to enable us to see that just as Joseph, despite his flaws, points forward to Christ, so also does Judah, despite his flaws, serve as a type and a picture and a pointer forward to Christ. One thing that we need to understand is the way in which the Old Testament examples, the Old Testament stories, in their very imperfections, raise longings that can be fulfilled only by Christ. So if the law had been able to accomplish the very good things toward which it pointed, there wouldn't have been a need for Christ to come. If the kings of the Old Testament had been able to fulfill the hopes that were placed upon them, there wouldn't have been a need for Christ to come. And this is how so much of the messianic hope of the Old Testament works, particularly in the book of Psalms, that David was a real king who really was a good king, and yet he was a very flawed king. And yet you have these Psalms of royalty that seem to be promising more than they can possibly fulfill. And that's how the messianic prophecies work, is you have these hopes that are placed on the kingship that no human king is ever going to be able to fulfill. And it points forward that as good as the kingship was, there's something better that is coming. As good as the law was, as gracious as the law was, there's a need for more grace in order to bring to fruition that to which the law could only point forward to. And I think we see that same thing with Judah, that we have this powerful self-sacrifice that Judah ultimately was not called upon to carry out, that was in a very flawed situation. Judah himself was very flawed. It was the less valuable offering himself in the place of someone that's more valuable. And when we understand that whole trajectory, we can see just how powerful the work of Christ really was. Here was someone who was not guilty, who was perfectly innocent, offering himself for those who were very guilty. Someone who was immensely valuable, offering himself for those who had sinned away any goodness or righteousness or value that they could perform. And so the very contrast between those details is what underscores and emphasizes the work of Christ. So any questions or comments up to this point? Any questions or comments finishing up the speech of Judah? I see a hand going up. So if you want to see, there we go. Josh, can you give, it looks like Lori has her hand.
Yep, they're ready to go.
All right, Lori.
Yeah, hi. Can you explain some more of the parallels between, you brought up Jesus's prayer in the garden. He asked the Father that not my will, but thine be done. Mm-hmm. And you paralleled that with Judah's position. I don't get that. What was Judah wanting? And what was Judah giving up in place of someone else's will?
Yeah, so that was drawing a little bit on what we talked about last week. I felt really bad that I had to break his speech up because it made some of this a little harder to follow. Let me just go back. Going back to verse 27, and thy servant, my father, said unto us, ye know that my wife bare me two sons. And the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces, and I saw him not since. And so if you hear what Jacob's actually saying, Jacob is not even treating Judah like his son. He's saying, my wife, Rachel, bore me two sons, that is Joseph and Benjamin. And yet Judah is so identified with the desires of his father that he's willing to pursue those desires. He knows what his father really cares about is Benjamin. And so he's doing everything in his power to preserve Benjamin for his father, even though his father cares more about Benjamin than he does about him. And so Judah is identified with Jacob's perspective, even though Jacob's, and all of this points forward, I think, but it points forward in an imperfect way, because obviously it would be better if, you know, Jacob didn't have favorites and all of that. But you still sense this total identification of Judah willing to sacrifice his own life to preserve the life of Benjamin, to preserve Benjamin for his father, that he's willing to give up everything that he has in order to accomplish his father's desire of bringing Benjamin safely back home. Does that address the question a little better? Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you. And just real quick, could you again reiterate the turning point that you saw in Judah's life? I know that you had mentioned that he was mm-hmm. in person. I kind of forgot that.
Yeah, so if you go back to chapter 38, you have really just this horrific story of Judah abusing his power and doing all kinds of things that I'm not going to go back over again now. It was hard enough going over them the first time. But the turning point in Judah's life is in verse 26, where Judah is bringing Tamar out and he's said that she should be burnt. And Tamar says, well, you know, who am I with child by? And she shows him his signet and his bracelets and his identification markers. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she hath been more righteous than I. And so the turning point in Judah's life is when he pursues repentance and says, I was wrong in what I did, where he openly acknowledges his failure. And really from, you know, then we, you know, that seems to be a turning point, because when we get to chapter 44, and really even in earlier in the chapter, earlier in the second journey in chapter 43, when we find Judah remonstrating with his father, coming forward as a spokesperson for the brothers as a whole, we find that Judah's position in the family has substantially changed. So before he was apart from the family, now he's leading the family. And so that's I think what the turning point is. But clearly when we get to chapter 44, his fundamental character has shifted in some very significant ways.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I don't think so.
All right. All right, so Judah pulls out all the rhetorical stops. He's every bit as persuasive. He's massages every detail to try to save Benjamin. So Judah thinks that Joseph is out to get Benjamin. And so Judah uses all his rhetorical effort in order to try to save Benjamin's life. But of course, Joseph knows full well that Benjamin is innocent. Joseph knows what's going on, and we find Joseph's response in 1 through 15 of the next chapter. And it seems like verses 1 through 2 are the perspective of the Egyptians from outside of the room, and then verses 3 through 15 give us another perspective on the same story. From inside the room. And it's important to note that both accounts end with Joseph weeping. So we'll come back to that we'll come back to that when we get to the end. So verses 1 and 2, then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard. And I think it's really important to note that Joseph didn't make his brother's shame known to the Egyptians. So Joseph's brothers had done him horribly wrong. And though Joseph had in many ways tested his brothers, and maybe even gone a little far in that testing, to even being willing to risk Jacob's life in order to make sure that he had proved his brothers and he had tested them, when it came time to reveal this very difficult matter and to have this heart-to-heart talk with them, he had that talk with them privately rather than shaming them before others. So while it's possible that Joseph's servant may have known what had taken place, you know, if you see Pharaoh's reaction to finding out about Joseph's brothers, there doesn't seem to be any hint that Pharaoh has any idea of what Joseph's brothers did. And when he has this big reveal to them, he sends all the Egyptians out and deals just with them. And there are times when it is very necessary to reveal sin, especially when to reveal someone else's sin, especially when a failure to openly deal with it or failure to maybe bring others into the situation would lead either to the sinner continuing a sinful pattern in their own life and bringing destruction upon themselves, or when there are others that may be sinned against that are going to be harmed. So potentially a situation of ongoing abuse when there's particularly someone in a position of power who is using that power to abuse others, that almost always has to be made known to others in order to bring that abuse of power to a stop. But there are many, many times when there's no need to make the sins of others known. The Bible says that love covers a multitude of sins, and I'm going to paste in to the chat here an application question. How might we be tempted to needlessly make known the sins of others in order to gain sympathy or approval? So there are many times when there is no need whatsoever for anyone else to know the way that you were wronged, the way that you were sinned against, especially if it happened a long time in the past, especially if it was done by someone who's no longer really in a position to harm you or others. We can sometimes dwell on the way we've been harmed so that others feel sympathy for us, so that it puts us in a better light when we say, all of these things have happened to me. These are all of the ways in which others have harmed me. And we want to make others look bad so that we look better. So how might we be tempted to needlessly make known the sins of others in order to gain the sympathy or approval of others? And Ruth Kinney commented in the group chat, I was just wondering, could Joseph have suspected that Judah was exaggerating their father's health? And I'm guessing you mean the danger to their father's health. And I think that is quite possible that Joseph probably thought potentially that he was exaggerating it. So that's part of the explanation to be sure, but I think there's a little more to it than that. So I think there's certainly some ambiguity in the story. But going back to the application question, how might we be tempted to needlessly make known the sins of others in order to gain sympathy and approval? Anyone? I see a physical hand being raised by Ashley.
I couldn't figure out how to raise my hand being on the computer now. I would say, how are we tempted to needlessly make known the sins of others? It definitely is needless, but I thought of the saying, hurt people. And when you watch someone that's really hurt you still be like validated by everyone else, it can be really, really hard to just watch their lives go on, even though maybe they've left your life kind of in ruins, and then you have the temptation of wanting to expose them for what they've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can be really hard to know when to discern when someone is, you know, because there are needs when someone does need to be exposed. So someone who's, you know, but there are many times when it doesn't. And I think really what it comes down to is, are we focused on the good and protection of others, or are we focused on validation and emotional support for ourselves? Cindy commented in the chat, I've forgiven them, but ... I need prayer for how to deal with how this person hurt me. You know, there may be times when that's legitimately a need, but there are many more times when we just want sympathy and we want others to, we want to put others down. And we can even do this anonymously. We can say, I'm not going to tell you who, but this person did all of these things to me. And we can, we want our hurt validated. Janine commented that. That is so true. And I think that's actually what I was getting at in the application question. Anyone else? Anyone else? Going once, going twice. All right, I don't see anyone else, so we will move on. But I think that's true. We want our hurt validated. And I think Joseph, in this case, sets a good example of not seeking to do that. And because of that, there's eventually full restoration that comes between him and his brothers. And so verses 1-2 gives the perspective of the Egyptians. The Egyptians go out, and then later on, the Egyptians hear this loud weeping. And so then we have the perspective from inside the room. And we'll come back to this inside-outside thing in a few minutes. But starting in verse 3, and Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. So it does seem, and this is one of the reasons why it seems, Nate Axto made a comment on the application question. Maybe when someone calls out your sin and you want to reciprocate, you want to say, hey, you're just as bad as I am. And, you know, you may have a list of things that I've done, but I have a list of things that you've done too. And that kind of self-defensive, self-protective, self-exalting attitude is one that always does more harm than good. And one of the reasons it seems like Judah's speech has alarmed Joseph, and it seems like Judah's speech is what led to Joseph's revelation of saying, I am Joseph, is because all of a sudden he asked, is my father still alive? And it seems like Joseph has become frightened enough for the possible implications of what's taken place for his father's life, that he's like, are you telling me the truth? Is Jacob still alive, or you've just been afraid to tell me what has taken place? And actually, no one answers this question, but you can sense that Joseph's perspective at this, from this point on, becomes much more aligned with Jacob, and indeed the perspective of the whole family that's been at odds. There's been this tension between Jacob, who wants to hold Benjamin at home, and Joseph, who wants to bring Benjamin to Egypt. This tension between Joseph, who wants to test his brothers, and his brothers, who just want to provide food for their families. And so there's been all of this conflict stretching back to Joseph's childhood. And from this point on, we're going to see how the brothers and the family indeed are going to come back together again. And Joseph is now more worried for his father than about accomplishing his own goals, important as those goals were, with his brothers. And his brothers, as you would expect, were very troubled. And the Hebrew word that's used here is very strong. It could be translated as they were terrified. They were in a panic. I mean, you can imagine they thought their brother was dead, and they thought this guy was out to get them. And then they find out that the person who's out to get them is someone with a very strong reason in their minds to want to destroy them. So you can imagine the terror that's falling upon them and the confusion that's coming over them. In verse 4, and Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. And while this is hardly something that would have allayed their fears at all, it would have only made them more terrified. It's something that only Joseph would have known. So this is convincing evidence to them that this is indeed Joseph. Remember, Joseph looked like an Egyptian. He talked like an Egyptian. He walked like an Egyptian. But now he's telling them something that only their Hebrew brother would have known. And if he had all the Egyptians go out, it's likely the interpreter went out as well. So it seems most obvious that he's speaking Hebrew to them, some form, whatever form of Hebrew there was at that time. And so they have no reason to doubt that it really is Joseph. They're just stupefied by this news. Then we find verses 5-8. Now therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath a famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God, and he hath made me a father to Pharaoh, the Lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. We'll talk first here about the central theological thrust of the passage, of this section, and then we'll get into some of the details. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. We find a parallel to this in Philippians 2:12-13, which I think is the clearest overall presentation of the balance between human freedom and divine sovereignty of anywhere in the scriptures. Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. On the one hand, you have the reality of human free action, of, in this case, of not of human pursuit of sanctification, but of human sin. So Joseph fully acknowledges the agency, the action, the choices of his brothers. He says, whom ye sold unto Egypt. So the brothers really sinned, and their sin had real... So he says, I am Joseph, whom ye sold. So that's going back into verse 4. So Joseph acknowledges his brothers really did sell him into Egypt. And you have in chapter 50 in verse 20, as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. So his brothers really did sell him, and they did so for evil intention, and God judged them for their evil action. Judas was not exempted from the consequence, Judas, the disciple of Jesus, was not exempted from the consequences of his actions because they led to our redemption. Mark 14:21 says, the Son of Man indeed goeth as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born. So Judas did what he wanted to do in betraying Jesus, and Judas was judged for what he wanted to do, because what Judas wanted, and again, speaking of Judas, Jesus' disciple, was evil. Joseph's brothers sold Joseph to Egypt because that's what they wanted to do. What they wanted was evil, and they merited divine judgment for that. And yet, the reality of human sin and the consequences for that sin are not the entirety of the story. What's repeated no less than 3 times, you have in verse 5, God did send me before you. Verse 7, and God sent me. Verse 8, so now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. So once again, you have God sent me repeated no less than 3 times. What we need to understand is that divine agency, so the word agency is a word that's used to describe who is doing something. So if you do, so the agent is the person who's accomplishing something. So if I, you know, swing a baseball bat and that, you know, causes a, you know, supposing I was a good baseball player, which I'm not, but if I were to swing a baseball bat and I was the one who hit the ball and caused it to be a grand slam, again, very unlikely if we were actually playing a game. But supposing I did that, I have agency. I chose, you know, I attempted to hit the ball. I did hit the ball. And because of that, I won a home run. So I exercised my agency as a human being to swing a baseball bat, hit the ball out of the stadium. I accomplished that goal. And that's human agency, right? You could, you know, you could be, you know, on strike or trying to throw the game, and you could attempt to not hit the ball. So you could exercise your agency, for instance, by dropping the bat and running away or doing something else with it. But as human beings, we have the ability to choose to do things. We do what we want to do, and we're responsible for the consequences of that. And we often have this idea, this is an image I've talked about before, that freedom or agency is something like a pie. So in order for us to have freedom as human beings, then that means God needs to have correspondingly less agency, less freedom. So if I can do what I want to do, then God can't do what he wants to do. This is not my view, but this is a view that people often have. Or if God can do whatever he wants to do, if God is sovereign, then human beings are therefore not free. But what we need to realize is that divine agency and human agency are not in competition. God is not trying to steal pieces of our freedom pie, as it were. The only reason we have any agency, we have any freedom at all, is because God has given it to us. And he has given us the freedom that is appropriate to a creature, not the freedom that is appropriate to the creator of all things. And so it is both true that we do what we want to do and are responsible and accountable for that. And it is also true that God works all things according to the counsel of his own will. And the simple truth is that because we are not God, it is impossible for us, not merely difficult, but actually impossible for us to reconcile those two things. And we have to be okay with that. We have to be okay with recognizing that we can't answer every question that we can raise. We can be clear that human freedom and divine freedom are not in competition. We can recognize both truths, but we have to just humbly bow before the reality that God is both sovereign and man is free. And really, the story of Joseph is one of the classic examples of the balance of between those two that we find all throughout the scriptures. But there's an application question I have here on this, that oftentimes we can be tempted to justify our sinful actions because everything turned out all right. So, you know, a child who did something they were not supposed to do. If we went back to our baseball bat and the baseball analogy, or suppose that the child was told, do not play baseball in the front yard because you could break a window. You can only play baseball at the park. And the children, being disobedient children, decide they're going to play baseball in the front yard anyways. And then the baseball, hits the window, predictably, because they're playing baseball in the front yard. And then it reveals that there was actually termite damage. There was a bigger problem. And so it actually ended up being a good thing that the window got broken, because it revealed a more dangerous problem that they were able to resolve. And so it all worked out for good. So therefore, you could imagine a child arguing, it really was okay. It actually was a good thing that I was disobeying, because it led to this good outcome. And all of you know children, especially teenagers, who would argue in that way. And all of us have argued probably in that way at some point in our life, that this bad thing that I did was actually okay because it led to this good outcome. But we're not responsible for the final outcomes of events. That's God's providence. That's a That's what belongs to God. We're responsible for what we decide to do. We're responsible for the use we make of our freedom, recognizing that God is the one who controls the final outcome. So how might we be tempted to justify sinful actions on the grounds that, you know, I may not have followed biblical principles for marriage, but, you know, my kids turned out okay. Or I may have ignored a biblical principle over here, but it turned out okay. So what would be some ways in which we'd be tempted, to justify sinful action on the grounds that things turned out okay anyways? Anyone? Going once. So what? How might we be tempted to justify? So I see Ashley's hand going up.
Thank you.
I still cannot find the raise hand feature anywhere on the computer.
So if you go to participants and you click on that, it brings up a little window at the bottom of which there's.
Oh, found it. Okay, thank you. I was thinking of it applies to money. Sometimes people will choose to not give the Lord his portion because they think like, oh, later on I'll like invest and do all these great money decisions and then I'll give when I have money. But a lot of times it seems like they struggle and the Lord isn't able to really bless them through that. So I can see that being a place that that would apply.
And they might feel that, and they might, you know, so on the one hand, yeah, I think that's true. And Janine commented, well, I only gossiped to get someone to pray for them. So, and someone did pray for them. So it all turned out okay. There was nothing wrong with my gossip, right? Lori has her hand up, Josh.
Yeah, so I was thinking like when I was a teen and my parents would say, warn me about things or say, when I was your age, this is what I would do differently. And I kind of said, ha, I don't really care. You know, I'm not you. I'm a lot younger. And then turns out what they did say was true. So maybe something like that is you think that those older than you are making it sound worse than it really is when they're really right. Or perhaps it's like pushing down or compromising on your standards, whatever they may be, just because people around you are or because you think you'll be fine. You can get close to sin and you'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, you might say, well, it turned out okay for you. So why can't I do the same thing? And maybe the Lord graciously delivered them from that. But if you're going into that same thing with full warning, you may not get off so easily. And so that's I think that's really important. I think that's with money, like what Ashley said, I think that's so true that we are tempted with money in many ways to say, well, you know, the you know, so you see that with people putting giving off. I also see, I've had a lot of conversations with people saying, well, the Lord is blessing my business, so my life must be fine. You know, I'm sinning against God in this area. I'm sinning against God in this area. I'm cheating on my taxes. I'm, you know, cutting corners over here. And yet I'm receiving divine blessings, so everything must be fine. And that is not always necessarily the case. Cindy commented, we want to assuage our guilt, and if we feel like we did the other person a favor in the end, then our guilt can be smothered. That is so true. That is exactly right. That if we can somehow make it work out in our minds for the other person, then we don't need to feel guilty about what we did. So that would be a number of different things. Let's go ahead and move on at this point. Unless there's anyone with doesn't look like there's anyone with their hand up. So there's a few other points here. So verse 5, now therefore be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. To preserve life, the wording is not exactly the same, but if you go to Genesis 6:18, you have, but with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. they shall be male and female. One of the key ways in which the Old Testament tells stories is how later stories echo earlier stories, and earlier stories pre-shadow later stories. And so it definitely seems, at a number of levels, and this is only one of them, like there's a link between a slight allusion here to the Noah story, to the story of the ark, that Joseph is like a new Noah who is keeping people alive. Verse 6, in the King James, you have, there'll be neither earring nor harvest. Joseph is not talking about Egyptian jewelry, as I'm sure all of you figured out, but the word earring is archaic English word that simply means to plow. So Joseph is saying there'll be neither plowing nor harvest. The famine's going to be so severe that not only is there going to be nothing to reap, but there's not even going to be any point in plowing the ground to sow more. So there'll be no plowing and there'll be no harvest. Verse 7, and God set me before you to preserve a posterity in the earth. And the word that's translated as posterity is the Hebrew word sherit, and it's a word that's normally translated as remnant. Indeed, many English translations will render that word remnant here in this passage. Now, at first glance, it seems a little odd. Why is Joseph talking about a remnant? Because the plan was to save all of Jacob's family, and that's indeed what took place. That because of what Joseph did, Jacob and all of his sons were preserved alive. But it's literally, but when we begin to realize how significant remnant language is in both the Old and the New Testament, we begin to see that this language isn't a mistake. We don't have to maybe interpret it in some other way, because much more is in view in Genesis than just the family of Jacob alone. I have a quote here from a commentator. The description on the earth, a remnant on earth, or on the earth actually, sets the descendants in a wider context. Joseph viewed the families of Jacob as the surviving remnant of the world's populations. See the Noah imagery in verse 5 that we already talked about. If the Jacobites fail to survive, that's the descendants of Jacob, the whole of the human family will die without salvation hope. Joseph's role as savior of the world from starvation typifies the salvation of the nations that the promises call for. And we find this remnant language is picked up in the New Testament as well. Acts 15:16, after this I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who doeth all these things. And in Acts, that's a quotation from the book of Amos, and indeed in the Hebrew text of Amos, you find this same word, remnant, sherit, that you have in the text of Genesis. So this is a theological theme that comes from really from the beginning, from the call of Abraham, that there's this clear sense in the text of Genesis that the call of Abraham is God's solution for the rebellion of the nations as a whole. And then in Acts 15, you have the coming of Christ as the fulfillment of that hope. And in Genesis, in preserving the sons of Jacob alive, Joseph is preserving the remnant on earth that will ultimately lead to the reversal of the curse and redemption, not just for the descendants of Jacob, but for all the peoples of the earth. So this concept of them as a remnant is not when you get, I think, the overall narrative flow of the text, it makes a lot of sense and really points out to something that's really key in the narrative. And in verse 8, you have, he hath made me a father to Pharaoh. And father, simply, the way it's being used there is as a moral authority. And so you have that often in the Old Testament kings and prophets and priests are referred to as fathers. So he's not saying that he was necessarily older than Pharaoh, just that he was someone to whom, from whom Pharaoh sought counsel, and the terms often used in that way. Verse 9, haste ye and go up to my father and say unto him, thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, tarry not. And thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt bow near unto me, thou and thy children and thy children's children, and thy flocks and thy herds, and all that thou hast. And there will I nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all that thou hast come to poverty. And behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin, that it is my mouth that speaketh unto you. And ye shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt, and of all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste and bring down my father hither. And so presumably Joseph thought Benjamin might impress his father more by saying, hey, Benjamin has seen this and he can testify about it. Verse 13, the first part, is very interesting. You shall bring down, well, not the first part, but you shall bring down my father. So in 44 and verse 29, when Judah is giving this vision of what Jacob had said, my gray hairs are going to be brought down with sorrow to the grave. And then in verse 13 of Joseph's speech, Joseph makes the point that he wants his father to know that he is going to go down to life, not to death. He's going to go down to Egypt, not to the grave. And the Hebrew word that's used is exactly the same. And then we find at the end of Joseph's speech in verse 13, just as father was at the beginning and end of Judah's speech. So if you recall, Judah used the word father 14 times. Joseph doesn't use the word father nearly that many times, but it's in the first and last sentence of his speech as well. And that's just an interesting observation. And verse 14, and he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brethren and wept upon them, and after that his brethren talked with him. And he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. So if you go back to verse 2, I said we'd come back to this, that, and he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. So verses 1 to 2 are portraying the event from the Egyptians' point of view. They didn't hear the conversation. They only heard the weeping that took place at the end of the conversation. When we get to verse 14, up to this point, there's been no mention of weeping. Now we've been told what took place inside the room. Nate says they didn't talk until verse 15 because their jaws were glued to the floor. There's probably some truth in that. But you can see that the fact that you have weeping at the end of both is a clue that we should see the two as being two different perspectives on the same event. And it's a very common feature of Hebrew narrative to describe the same event from multiple perspectives. And this is something that, while we can usually figure this out in stories, it's something that also takes place in the prophets and in the book of Revelation as well. I think one of the clues to understanding the book of Revelation is how Hebraic, how much it's written like the books of the Old Testament are written. And one of the key ways in which you can use to figure some of the prophetic books out is the way in which they'll describe an event from beginning to end from one perspective, and then they'll start over again, and then sometimes they'll start over again, and sometimes you have this overlapping pattern multiple times. Usually not in a narrative, it'll just be two times or maybe three times. But this is a common tendency of the way that Hebrew literature is written, the way that they would think of sort of, one scholar has compared it to stereo sound, that you hear something coming from the, you know, right ear and something coming from the left ear, and together it makes a richer sound than one by itself could be. And when you have true stereo sound, and I'm going to get out of my depth of the audio here, what you're hearing with the right and what you're hearing with the left are actually different, but together they are, they're communicating the same song. And so that's an analogy that's helpful, and I think that's what's taking place in a much more limited way here. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then we'll be done. Father, I come before you, and I thank you for everyone who took the time to participate in this discussion and in studying your word together. I pray you'd help each of us to be faithful to you. I pray for John and Deborah that you'd give them a safe and a swift delivery. I pray you'd give them protection as they're in the hospital. I pray you'd help each of us, Father, Lord, as we approach Easter, to think of ways to make this an evangelistic opportunity, even though we can't be gathered together as we would desire to be. Help us to be faithful to you. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.